Welcome to the dialogue series Dancing in the Liminal, a global border-crossing inquiry into art, activism, spirituality, and leadership for the 21st century. I'm your dialogue hostess, Vanessa Fisher, and I'm here with my honored guest, Marina Namat. Marina was born in 1965 in Tehran. After the Islamic Revolution of 1979, she was arrested at the age of 16 and spent more than 2 years in Evin, a political prison in Tehran, where she was tortured and came very close to execution. Marina came to Canada in 1991, and her memoir, Prisoner of Tehran, was published in 2007, since becoming an international bestseller, published in 28 other countries. And in 2007, Marina also received the inaugural Human Dignity Award from the European Parliament. And she's since written her second book After Tehran, A Life Reclaimed. So I recently came across Marina's work, and I had the chance to read her memoir, Prisoner of Tehran, which was a very powerful read for me. I really highly recommend it. And I was really inspired to invite Marina to be a guest on my dialogue series to share her own journey, her story, as well as give her unique perspective on the political situation in Iran to highlight some of the international issues that she's currently engaged in. So, Marina, it's a real honor to have you. So thank you for being on my dialogue series.
Thank you for having me, Vanessa. It's a pleasure.
So I thought to start, it would be great for those of my listeners who just don't have a lot of background in Iranian history, if you could just give a little bit of a brief context to what was happening in Iran politically, socially, leading up to the Islamic Revolution. Many people today, particularly in the West, tend to think of Iran as a pretty repressive, theocratic state. But things weren't always this way. And so how has Iran as a country become what it is today?
Well, in general, Iran is the same as the Persian Empire, and it has been around for thousands of years. And 3,000 years ago, it was basically most of the world, most of the civilized world. And then, you know, of course, during wars and, you know, all of that, it shrunk. And right now the country is called Iran. So the Iranian culture and history goes way back, even before Islam, because the Arabs attacked Iran in the 7th century and brought their religion Islam with them. Before that, Iran was a Zoroastrian country. Of course, today, 98 to 99% of the population of Iran are Muslim. When my grandparents escaped the Russian Revolution just shortly after 1917 and ended up in Iran, Iran was very different from Russia. Iran, it was at that time not a very modern country at all by any stretch of imagination. But during the lives of my grandparents and my parents, during the time of the father of the Shah, who was called Reza Shah, and then the Shah himself, who was ousted in 1979 during the Islamic Revolution, even though both men, both Reza Shah and his son, the Shah, they were, you know, I guess any way you want to measure them, they were considered dictators because they did not tolerate any form of political dissidence or criticism. Yet the father of the Shah, he built a railroad system, he built roads, he built the very first modern university in Iran, the University of Tehran. He built many schools, and he basically created a functional government which had been non-existent in Iran for quite some time. And he basically changed the face of the country. And actually, the father of the Shah, and at the time, again, the majority of the people of Iran were Muslim, he actually made wearing the hijab illegal. So up to the point, culturally, you know, I'm not even sure, you know, because it's difficult to differentiate between culture and religion. You know, where does one end and the other one start? I mean, I don't even know. But right. When my grandmothers arrived in Iran around 1920, they were Christian women, but every woman they saw on the streets in Tehran, they wore the hijab. And of course, they were forced to wear it. Not that there was a law, but it was just that when everybody else is wearing it, you would do it as well. But then the father of the Shah, around, I think it was around 1930, right, he actually made the hijab illegal because he wanted the women of Iran to take part in social life. And he believed that the hijab would stop that. So fast forward, when I was born in 1965, when I was growing up, I was wearing miniskirts on the streets of Tehran. And I lived in downtown. When I looked out of my window, 90% of women, maybe more, this was not a rich neighborhood, this was just downtown, wore tight t-shirts and miniskirts. And I spent my summers at the Caspian Sea. I became a teenager just before the success of the revolution in 1979. So I was 13. 15, and I was wearing little bikinis on the beach, and it was not unusual at all. I mean, at least in that part of the Caspian, but any part of the Caspian, really. If you went to the seaside during the summer, just before the revolution in 1978, you would see the majority of women wearing bathing suits, and many of them were bikinis, and it was just fine. And men and women were together back then during the time of the Shah, even though he was a dictator and he didn't tolerate any criticism. But people had personal freedoms. Women could become judges. A woman could even become the prime minister. And women were being widely educated in Iran. And again, the Western way of life had become quite the norm. There were many cabarets in downtown Tehran. People would be going out. They would be drinking. And it was just fine. So this is the world that I grew up in. I was listening to the music of the Bee Gees. I was watching The Little House on the Prairie, dubbed into Farsi, the Donny and Marie Osmond show. And I had dreams of becoming a medical doctor. So this was in 1978, just before the success of the revolution.
And your parents, your dad was a dance teacher, right? And your mother owned a beauty parlor, was that right?
Yes, that's right. Now, down in Tehran, we rented two apartments. In one of them, my dad taught ballroom dancing. And in the other one, my mother ran her beauty salon.
Right. And you have a bit of an interesting, you were a bit of a unique position because you have this Russian background and you were actually Christian in a largely Islamic culture. But that was also very allowed in the time of the Shah.
Yeah. You know, it is still allowed. Like, I mean, to be a Christian, according to the Iranian constitution, back then, I mean, during the time of the Shah, religion was not an issue at all. Again, the laws were very secular. I went to a Zoroastrian high school for girls, which accepted girls from all religions. And we had Jews, we had Baha'i, we had Christians, we had Zoroastrians, we had Muslims, we had everything. Now that the laws of Iran are based on Sharia law, according to Iranian law, one is allowed to be a Christian or a Jew or a Zoroastrian, but one is not allowed to be a Baha'i. So nowadays, you're allowed, like there's still probably, you know, religious minorities in Iran right now. They constitute about less than 2% of the Iranian population. But being a Christian is allowed, being a Jew is allowed, being Zoroastrian is allowed, but being a Baha'i is not. And, Iran tolerates other religions, the Iranian government, but as long as you don't advertise your religion. So as soon as you try to advertise your religion to Muslims and convert them to your religion, then you're in big trouble. But as long as you keep your nose in your own business, Christians do have churches. There have been some difficulties with Christian schools. Many of them have been shut down and they have been confiscated. So there have been issues, not that they haven't been issues. It's not entirely free and happy for Christians or for Jews or for Zoroastrians. There have been many big problems. But in general, according to the letter of the law, one is allowed to practice these other three religions.
Okay. So, well, let's back up a little bit. I'd love to go a bit more into your personal story. Obviously, that's sort of the core of what started your work and brought your voice out. And I just wanted to hear a bit about what sort of led up to your wrist was when you were 16 years old. You were in high school, right?
Yes.
And you were taken to the notorious political prison in Tehran, Evin. You know, I heard you say somewhere that, I don't know if it was just at that time or if it's still the case, but that 80% of the prisoners were under the age of 18.
Actually, during my time, it was 90. So it was in the 80s. I mean, because a mass wave of arrests of young people in Iran, young, I mean really young, okay, we are talking about between 13 and 18, began in 1981 because there were massive protests on the streets of Tehran beginning in 1980 when the Islamic revolution that had promised to deliver freedom and democracy failed very obviously to deliver it because Sharia law came in. And when Sharia law came in, it began to limit personal, not only political liberties, forget about political liberties, it began to limit extremely, in a very extreme way, personal liberties. And we were a bunch of kids who had grown up during the time of the Shah dancing to the Bee Gees in bikinis. So naturally, it was very difficult for us to tolerate the situation. We were on the streets. I mean, we were a bunch of teenagers rebelling against very extreme laws. laws. And as a result, you know, the government that was becoming more powerful by the day, the Islamic Republic, it began to crack down, and the war with Iraq had started. So basically, it had national security in mind kind of thing during the time of war. So, you know, during time of war, governments get away with a whole lot, and not only the government of Iran. So they began to crack down, and the arrests began. So when I was arrested in 1982, and I was not at all the first one to be arrested from my high school, when I looked around me in Evin prison in January 1982, honestly, 90% or more were basically between the ages of 13 and 20. Now, people argue about how many political prisoners are even there right now in Evin prison. I have seen various numbers from 2,000 to 7,000. So, I mean, who knows?
But there, and the time that you were there, how many would you say?
Oh my gosh, it was more than that. It was much more than that. So I, there's no way, because there's no census.
Right.
But there's nothing, you know. But this I can tell you for sure. The cells that we were in the cell block, I was in 246, which is still there. The prison was built during the time of the Shah. In every one of those cells, during the time of the Shah, there were about 5 prisoners. During my time, there were 50, 60, or 70. And now, I guess depending on whether they have been recent rallies on the streets or not, I think the number could be probably anywhere between 10 to 20. So, you know, you can do kind of the math to get a general idea of how the population of the prison has fluctuated throughout the years. And now, in 1988, there was a mass execution of political prisoners. Most of the people in 1988, they had been in prison since 1981, 82, 83, and they had been tortured severely. So in 1988, the government of Iran basically decided that, you know what, it has either broken these prisoners, it can release them basically because they are broken, or it has not succeeded. And if it has not succeeded in the few years, it will never succeed. So people were either released or they were executed in 1988. And then, of course, after that, there were more arrests. So the population went up again.
Hmm. Now, when you went into the prison, I'm curious, because I know the circumstances with you getting there was... What, could you just want to share what had happened in your classroom that led to being imprisoned?
Sure. I was about 14 years old. I was in the 9th grade, and it was shortly after the revolution. I was in the 8th grade when the revolution succeeded, so about a year later. We were in school, and most of our teachers, you know, it took about a year, but most of our teachers who were very qualified during the time of the Shah, we had very good teachers. I went to Anushiravani Dadgar High School in Tehran, that is right now still operational. Very good school in Tehran, belongs to Zoroastrians. And then after the revolution, one by one, our teachers were either forced into retirement or they were replaced by fanatic young women who were not qualified to teach. They were members of the newly formed Revolutionary Guard, and their job was to implement the Iranian Cultural Revolution. And where do you start the Cultural Revolution? Of course, in schools. So they shut down universities, mm-hmm. but they couldn't shut down high schools. So what they did is they put in their own people to brainwash the young population. So a few months in, we found ourselves sitting through propaganda 7 hours a day and religious studies, of course. And again, we were the generation of the BGs and that.
Right.
You know, so it was really hard to swallow, as you can imagine. And 14, 15-year-olds, they rebel against the color of the wall.
Yeah.
You know, you can't sing, you can't dance, you can't go out with boys, you can't do anything. Fun basically became illegal. So... We were upset, and I was sitting at calculus, and I was really at the end of my rope. And this young woman, she had no idea what she was talking about. She was talking religious studies. I got totally fed up, and I raised my hand and I said, "Miss, listen, if you want to teach calculus, great. If this is what you're teaching, I really don't like it. So it's a calculus class. Can you please teach calculus?" And she said, "Oh, you don't like what I teach? Leave." And I said, "Fine." So I was angry. I collected my books and I walked out. And I get into the hallway and I realized most of my friends had followed me out. So we were standing in the hallway laughing our heads off. We had just walked out on the teacher. It was funny. So we went in the yard, and we saw, you know how girls are. It was a girls' school, and big school, hundreds of students, and, you know, the word spreads, right, like wildfire. So the bell rang, you know, it's recess. Everybody's like, oh, you know, this is what we did. We all walked out, and everybody's like, oh, that's a great idea. Let's do the same thing. You know, we are going to show them. And suddenly, basically, there was a revolution in the school. So all the classes, the kids were not going to class. They were saying, oh, you know what? We want our math. We want our sciences. We want our biology, you know, whatever. And it was chaos. It was absolute chaos. And it took about 3 days. The principal, the Revolutionary Guard, called us to the office and said, listen, you either go back to class or I will call the course of Islamic justice and they will come and deal with you. Is that clear? And we had heard horror stories about the course of Islamic justice. They basically executed people for no good reason. So there were three of us standing in the office. We were the representatives of the students. And we all looked at each other and we said, uh-oh, okay, we made our point. Let's go back. So we went back to class. Of course, nothing changed. But the principal, what she was doing at that time was that she had a list that one of the teachers managed to see, and she informed us, she told us what she had seen, that there were the names of the anti-revolutionary students, the names of us on this blacklist. And of course, that blacklist was later submitted to the course of Islamic justice, and all of us on the list ended up in the prison. There were about 50 names.
And you never considered yourself a political activist. I mean, at some level, you were just a young person rebelling, you know, like anyone. I mean, I could imagine someone in North America doing that and considering it pretty harmless.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm not political. My family were not political. I mean, I probably couldn't even spell politics, you know. I had no idea. I just was a young girl. I'm by nature still today a fun-loving person. I love just to have good fun. And that is that was my life. And they had taken it away from me. And I was going to do something about it.
So tell us a bit about entering Evine. I mean, it must have been kind of surreal. I imagine it wasn't really something you'd imagined you'd be ending up in a place like this.
No, I mean, who does that?
Yeah, totally. I mean, even if it was in the country and you knew it existed, it must have not really felt real in some way.
No, not at all. Actually, I just recently met a young man and from Iran, just arrived in Canada recently. He's like, not even 18, it was a high school, so like 17. He has had grown up in Tehran. Like, Evine is entirely operational. And he comes up to me and he says, oh, where is Evine in Tehran? And I mean, you know, for him to ask me that, you know, this young man didn't know where Evine was, because everybody knows it's there, right? But for young people, especially, they have heard it's like this boogeyman. Is it real? Is it fake? Oh my gosh, it's out there to get you. But you know, people don't talk about it. People hush it. And, you know, it's almost, it feels like a myth when it is not. It's very real.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about your experience when you first came into Evine, and you were in for 2 years. So what happened in that? I mean, and obviously you can't share everything, but some key points of your experience in that time.
I mean, the moment you walk through the doors of Evine, your whole perspective shifts. So basically, it's as if they put you in a cannon and they shoot you to another planet, and all of a sudden, the laws of gravity are different. So the first thing they do, they blindfold you. And it's the same today. And it is an intimidation technique, because when you don't see where you're going, you become much more vulnerable. So basically, every step you take is a huge risk. You could be walking off a cliff and you wouldn't know it. They could shove you down the stairs, which they used to do to a lot of prisoners. And you wouldn't even know what hit you. So they walked me along hallways. Evine is a huge compound located north of Tehran, and it's a vast area. It has many buildings. So hallway after hallway, they made me sit down. Then eventually somebody called my name. They took me for interrogation. And of course, they were not happy with what I told them. So they took me to another room. And I think, you know, in that small room in Evine prison, it was the first night that I arrived there, a few hours. Maybe it was the second day. I mean, my whole conception of time is a little messed up when it comes to the first few days. But they took off my blindfold, and there was a small room. I was in a room with two men, Ali and Hamid. And there was a desk, two chairs, a bare wooden bed. And they handcuffed me. And when they handcuffed me, I was very small. I was like 95 pounds. And they saw that my hands are going to slide out of the cuff. So they put both of my wrists together. They put the two wrists in one cuff. As it clicked, I literally heard my right wrist crack. And I screamed, and I mean, if the devil had appeared, I would have sold my soul to go home and sleep in my own bed. I mean, I had no education or no understanding of what torture means. Mm-hmm. My dad had slapped me quite a few times, actually, when growing up, or my mother had slapped me. But that was my whole understanding of getting beat up. So I was completely clueless, but I just knew that this is really bad. But I still had no idea how bad it really is. So they tied me up to the bed. They took off my socks and my shoes. And I had Puma running shoes. I had just bought them. I loved them. Never saw them again. And they, one of the men, Hamid, he lashed the soles of my feet with a length of cable. Now, this length of cable, it is about an inch thick. It is full rubber. And these guys who do this to people, they are strong men and they use full force. So they are not kidding you. And the Chinese would tell you that your nerve ends are in your feet. And I think they are right. Because with every strike, your whole nervous system blows up. And then
this is the most common form of torture that they did, right?
Yeah, it is the most common because it is extremely effective in instilling the most amount of pain. And, you know, because they are beating your feet, so, you know, they can put you on TV right after it, and nobody is going to see the injuries.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So they could put you in front of your family right after that. As long as they don't see your feet,
right,
you know, you're going to look just fine. It is quite scary, actually, how, you know, they would beat somebody up and then they would put them immediately on TV, or they would beat somebody up like that and they would put them in front of their family to say, oh, I'm fine, everything is fine.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's very common. And so I think, you know, being under torture, I think it completely changed my understanding. It introduced me to a space that I didn't know existed in the universe, a place of distilled pain, suffering, darkness, and evil. And this was not a kind of evil that just appeared from a UFO or something. These were people doing this. That changed everything. I had grown up as a Catholic. I had been reading the lives of saints. I had been reading, you know, about these people who had been, you know, tortured, crucified. And to me, when reading them, it was like fiction. It was like reading Jane Austen. It didn't ring true. It was, okay, maybe this happened 2,000 years ago, but that doesn't happen anymore. And then I'm in this room with these two guys, and it is happening right here, and I was ready to sell my soul. And I realized I'm no saint material. The realization that I would do anything to get out of this room and go home, it hit me quite hard. You know what torture does? It's not really to get information, because you know, your brain goes into this overactive mode and you come up with the most creative lies ever told. Whatever you think they want to hear, you're going to tell them. And none of this is true. Of course, because you're just so panic-stricken that, you know, your brain is just a very strange place. So torture has nothing to do with information. Torture is about killing the human soul. And I think that realization that, you know, that vulnerability of the soul, that was what scared me a great deal.
Well, that's what I actually really appreciated about your book. Was I liked how you described your own realize, like, just, you had a friend, I think, that had given your name to the detention center under torture, and you were just like, I totally understand.
Yeah.
Like, you know, or like you just were very compassionate to, like, I probably would have too. There was just a very compassionate response.
Oh my gosh, completely. I mean, I get it. You know, I mean, I always say, people, if they torture you and they want information about me, like, I mean, even today, I sometimes jokingly say to my friends and family, people, if they kidnap you and they want information about me, please tell them everything. Just don't wait. You know, don't wait until you get to the torture room. Just try to stay away out of the torture room. Like, try not to even get in there. Because, you know, to have that expectation, I know there are extremist political groups out there that would indoctrinate their members, and they would tell them that, you know, if they're arrested, you know, they have to persevere until death, and, you know, this and that. And I have no such expectations. You know, I would always tell people, you know what, that space, that place where they put you, please don't allow them to push you in there, because it is beyond your craziest nightmares. Just please don't get in there.
And at 16 years old, I mean, I can't even imagine.
Yeah, in a way, actually, I think maybe that was good because I was so innocent that everything hit me basically at face value. And, you know, the beauty about being young is that you fall and you get up. You fall, you get up. You fall, you get up. I mean, today, I am sure I wouldn't be able to be so bouncy. You know, you keep on bouncing out of things. You keep on, because you don't have, you know, experience can bring a lot of negativity. When you have so much experience, when you know so much about human nature and the fact that we are not saints, I guess you can't help it. You know, no matter how optimistic you are, or what a positive person you are, there is a certain amount of negativity that would accumulate. And I didn't have that. I was just a happy kid. I loved my friends, and I had lived not a, you know, a fairy tale life by any stretch, but, you know, an okay life. So for me, it was this extreme force that put me down, but then I bounced right out.
Well, I'd say I felt that kind of like a resiliency in reading your book too, and I think that makes a lot of sense having you say that, you know, and maybe someone in a different position would have just committed suicide or, you know, tried to end it. And you just kind of kept going with, I mean, obviously you also had pressures with the interrogator, Ali, and that sort of shifted things.
Well, he called me. I was called for interrogation about 5 months after I had been arrested. And people were called for interrogation constantly, but they would usually come back bloody and swollen. Girls were called at midnight. They were returned to the block at 5 a.m. with no visible torture signs. And if you ask them, where were you? They'd say, oh, they took me for interrogation. Nothing happened, which sounded really odd. But then it was obvious they didn't want to talk about it. So you would back off. So I was called for interrogation 5 months after my arrest. And Ali, he took off my blindfold, looked at me in the eye and said, listen, you had a death sentence, was reduced to life in prison. And I want you to become my wife. And if you do, things might get a little bit easier here for you, not that you would be released. And he said, if you don't, I will arrest your parents and your boyfriend. And he seemed to be very serious about it. And I knew after having been in Evin for 5 months that people do end up here because they are somebody's mom or dad or brother or sister. Basically, they are hostages. So I said, fine, you know, whatever you want me to do, just tell me, I will do it. And then he eventually told me that he wanted me to convert to Islam. I said, fine. He even changed my name. And I was forced to marry him when I was 17 and would take me on short leaves of absence to visit his family and that sort of thing. But it was a surreal, but, you know, I mean, in a surreal place, a surreal experience doesn't stand out.
Yes,
you know,
yeah.
So people are being tortured all around you, when people are being beaten to a pulp, when, you know, every night you have the sound of mass executions. It's like thunder out there. And, you know, this is the sound of people dying. I mean, you get to a point that you can take almost anything. I asked him to move me to solitary confinement because I couldn't face my friends. And I was physically, I was very ill. I was throwing up constantly. So I was very unwell. And, you know, I said to him, I want to be in solitary. And he said, fine. I was basically being raped every night. It was rape. At the beginning, at least, I would scream the whole way through. Mm-hmm. So that was my life. And then during the day, I mean, I had a copy of the Quran, but rather than reading the Quran, which you can read so much, I would just sit and stare at the walls, or I would sleep because, you know, it was easier to sleep during the day, sleep at night. And that was my life. And of course, the visits to his family, who were absolutely amazing, lovely people, and they shocked me out of my wits because I expected his family to be mean, cruel, torturing kind of people. And then there we go. They are normal people. They are kind. They are very accepting. They embrace me. They feed me. They never said one mean word to me. Then his mother tells me that he had been a political prisoner in Evin prison during the time of the Shah. He had been tortured much more than I had been, probably. Mm-hmm. So then that suddenly there was this understanding, this epiphany, that the man that I consider to be entirely evil, a torturer, he's the torturer, I'm the victim.
Yeah.
I realized that we have so much in common because he had been a victim. Now he's a torturer, but it made me think, I'm a victim today, but could I be a torturer tomorrow? It brought out a lot of thoughts, a lot of confusion.
Yeah.
For sure, because inside the prison, he had been protecting me. I had the death sentence originally. So there were those in Evin prison that they wanted me dead. And I knew he's standing in the way. as long as I have his protection, I'm safe. He was somebody, of course, originally I didn't trust at all. But then the only person I could trust in any way to protect me against the rest of these crazy people.
And it was his parents who eventually got you freed from the prison.
Yeah, they did. So when he was assassinated, then I had a 3-year sentence. So there was still a few months left of my sentence. And so his parents, when he died, his father told me that I will get you out as soon as I can. So he needed to get a pardon for me from the Ayatollah. And he said, well, it will take time, but I'll do it. But there were authorities in the prison, including the warden of the prison, the head of Evin prison, Asadullah Lajavadi. He didn't want me to leave. So he stood in the way. So there was this power struggle between them. I think, you know, his parents bribed everybody and used their influence. They didn't tell me exactly what they did. But it was 6 months after his death, finally, my name was called and they let me go.
And you fled to Canada with your teen lover, right?
Yeah, my boyfriend. Yeah, we married. Well, it took 6 years. So I was released in 1984 and the government wouldn't let me leave. I wasn't allowed to exit the country. So it took about 6 years. And at the end, I had to ply a horrendous amount of money, sign documents that I wouldn't say anything against the government, until they finally gave me a passport. And that was when I left, together with my husband, who had been my boyfriend before I was arrested. And at that point, we had a son. He wasn't 2 yet. We went to Spain first, then to Hungary, then from Hungary to Canada.
And when did you start writing? Was that right away or
No. I was entirely, like, I'm still suffering from PTSD. And the earliest stages of this psychological disorder, which is quite extreme, it's, you know, you're basically in emotional coma. It's, you create a false self that is normal. I created a false self, a Marina that was normal, had never been arrested, had never been tortured, had never been raped, had never, you know, none of the above. And was just a normal person. You know, I had married, I had a husband, I had a child. I mean, I was a wife and a mother. That's it. No political prisoner here. So I created that and I avoided any thought of prison, of the past, of everything. But of course, that's impossible to maintain forever. So eventually when we got to Canada, of course, I brought my parents here immediately. And then in 2000, my mother became ill and she had cancer. And when she died, I was sitting at her bedside and I was looking at her and I was thinking, I don't even know who this woman is, because we have never talked about anything. We have never discussed what happened. And I think that was when the symptoms of PTSD began to emerge, actually. So I started having psychotic episodes, screaming episodes, banging my head against the wall episodes. And basically, I became completely dysfunctional. And that was when I realized I need to deal with it, which I started to do slowly. And writing was a part of that, let's deal with it, process.
Was that a very healing process for you, writing the book? Or was it
not
actually quite...
No,
it's actually excruciating.
Well, yeah, to a very, you know how when your foot falls asleep and then blood is returning to it?
Yeah.
So it was excruciating, but because I teach memoir writing now, and I always tell my students, listen, you know, the word healing is the wrong word for this. The right word, the only thing I can think of is to deal with it. You're dealing with it. You know, if you say heal, it means it's like the flu. You know, you catch the flu or you catch a stomach bug and you're going to heal. You know, you're going to rest, you're going to have some soup and you're going to take medication and you're going to be just fine. But this is not it. This is not going to go away. It's going to always be somewhere in you. The issue is that you have to let it breathe. You have to acknowledge it. You have to allow it to peep out its ugly head. And you have to try to control it. That's basically what writing allows us to do, to put things on paper, make sense of them, deal with them, and put things in perspective.
And objectified in a way, like make it less subject, right? So we're actually able to look at it,
Sure.
And then that obviously led to the work that you ended up doing, which I'm sure has also added to your own, won't call it healing process, but this continual process of stepping out into your voice and really being an advocate for the people who didn't get a voice and didn't get to write their story.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I'm always constantly reminding myself, you know, because by, you know, people who know me, who meet me, they always tell me, oh, you don't look like a torture victim, you know, and you know, always a question mark. Like, what does a torture victim look like? You know, like, you know, do you have an image of somebody in chains with like blood dripping all over, you know, and I'm very aware of these psychological issues that I have, you know, things can set me off quite easily. And, you know, we have to be aware that people who have gone through extreme trauma, they have a slightly shorter level, like, you know, smaller, lower level of tolerance. Sometimes, you know, certain things that might seem even normal, you know, we can set us off because we have certain sensitivities that I hate to use the word normal, but, you know, normal people don't have. So this is something I'm aware of. And if I'm ever in a situation, I usually try to get out if I feel that it's triggering my PTSD.
Right. And I do notice that, you know, I've done a lot of work and had interest around working with people with mental illness. And I do find that people who are able to come through their experiences of deep trauma, that they do tend to have a certain kind of equanimity that maybe even the average person doesn't, but it's actually because they're much more having to pay attention to themselves and the world around them. And that's actually part of the equanimity that comes with it. But yeah, there's a real sensitivity that stays and you never fully get over.
Yeah, there needs to be awareness about these issues because I have even worked with like human rights organizations that have no idea, you know, how complicated and sensitive when they work with people who are PTSD sufferers. You need to realize that there are certain sensitivities here that need to be respected. It's just simple, pure knowledge and then respect that, you know, it needs to be acknowledged.
Yeah, I had a psychiatrist once tell me that, you know, in our culture, we've made a lot of room for understanding physical disability, but when it comes to mental, like, there's still so much stigma, there's still so much misunderstanding in the culture, and it's really not been brought to light. I mean, small, yes, but there's so far to still go.
Yeah, absolutely. And to realize that, you know, people who have these issues, they can be functional and very formal looking. It's just that the issue is still there. And, you know, the fact that if you have a psychotic episode, it doesn't mean that you will never, ever be able to live normally again. You know, it doesn't mean it's an episode. It's like having epilepsy. Okay, so you have a seizure. And then after that, you know, you use your methods, you know, whatever, and you go on.
Yeah. And I know you're running out of time. I wanted to ask you just, I know you faced some people basically calling you a traitor, people from your own country. Yeah. I'm curious what that backlash was and how that impacted you, if you wanted to sort of just share a little bit before you go.
Oh, you know what? When it came, it was really upsetting because, I mean, in my book, I have been very, very vocal about the fact that, you know what, I broke under torture. Okay, I would have sold my soul. I mean, I married my interrogator. I lived with him. You know, all of this. There's nothing that somebody else has come out and said about. I have said it very openly. I have said it in detail. I have talked about it in public. For some political prisoners, ex-political prisoners, of course, they're a very small group. I mean, I'm in touch with my cellmates. I have met some. You know, I have had meetings with some of them recently. And I mean, you know, the majority of us, we are people who understand that when you're put in a torture room, you're going to break, you're going to give information, you're going to do whatever, you know, whatever it takes to get out of that room. And we respect that because we have been there, we have done that, and we understand human limitations. But there are certain people who believe in heroism and they believe in heroes. And I don't know why they feel that it is a necessity for a political prisoner to be a hero, to be perfect, to never break, to never, you know, be human, basically. So, you know, I don't know what it is, but in a way, I think this is a self-defense mechanism that some people have difficulty to come out and say, you know, I broke. Because I believe that everybody who survived in prison ever broke. Because the ones who didn't, they died. You know, that was the purpose of going inside in prison. They either break you or kill you. There is no other way. There's not a third option here. So you either at least seem like you have broken, so you need to give confessions, you need to say, I will never do it again, I totally respect the Islamic Republic, and they would even record it, so there would be videos of it. You had to say it on camera, and they would keep it on your file. It was either that, or they would shoot you. or you would die under torture. Right. There was no other way. Right. So, I mean, you know, I think some people, you're trying to protect themselves, their ideology. I don't know what it is, but I understand it. I don't necessarily blame them. It's very upsetting to me when I hear that. But, you know, if it makes them feel better, I mean, I'm very open about it. Yes, I did break under torture. If you want to consider me a traitor, yeah, so be it. You know, that's just fine.
Well, it's also what allowed you to have the voice for those people, being able to do the writing that you did. I mean, you had to take the position that you did to do that.
Yeah, you can't please everybody. I mean, I can hope that, you know, through my personal story, the stories of others has been told, and I'm in touch with a lot of my cellmates, and they are very happy and pleased that I did write, of course, but there are some unhappy people out there too, and I wish I could please everybody, but I can't.
Well, I think you're doing amazing work, and I'm so glad your voice is out there, and it seems like you're getting lots of good airtime to share your story, so I'm grateful for that, and really grateful that you were take the time to just talk with me. So,
oh no, thank you very much. Thank you so much for having me. You take care.
Yes, and good luck with everything.
Thank you, I need it. Take care.